The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We are here.
We are here. Kick this off. Hey, what's up, guys? I've got a good buddy, Shep Rose, who you most likely know from the Bravo TV series, which 10 seasons.
Going to be about 10 coming up here soon, yep.
Southern Charm.
Yep.
is there a cap on the amount of seasons
they
can do?
No.
It just keeps going.
Look, this is my quick take. It's really hard to make a TV show that people care about, watch, and talk about. And that's why you hear in Hollywood, right? It got canceled. Oh, we filmed a pilot. It went nowhere. Season one, we got canceled. It was a misunderstanding or whatever. But if you get that traction and that snowball effect, then, and that means you can sell advertising, right? And then it's just like, why not? Why not?
Yeah. Of course,
it's dollars and cents.
The network is going to continue down that road. But hey, Shep, you know, one of the things I want to dive into is your life. I know tomorrow we're going to do another podcast with John Wellborn, Sanjay Ribeiro, who I'm sure you'll be good to see.
Yep.
Yourself and me, let's call it a debrief on Rythmia, which should be pretty funny and intense in certain ways. But, you know, one of the things, the TV shows don't totally dive into who you are, the background, where you were born and raised, man. Just give for the listeners and the viewers just your background.
Sure. My favorite subject and my first love, me. No, I'd be happy to. First of all, I want to thank you guys for having me. And it was such a pleasure to meet you guys in Costa Rica. Unexpected, because we were all, y'all were together. So that helps a little esprit de corps there. But I didn't know anybody. And I was feeling my way around, which is fun, I think. You know, you put yourself in an uncomfortable position and you grow that way. And being a stranger in a strange land is always interesting. It's just interesting. And so I was pleased to meet you guys fairly quickly in the process, because that made me feel, okay, there's some people who are somewhat like me, or the same mindset at least. Because there's a lot of kumbaya, there's a lot of yoga, there's a lot of breathing. I don't have any experience in that. So you almost feel inadequate on some levels, you know?
We were a bunch of dudes. You're like, okay, they're the dudes.
Yeah.
And you fell right in with the crew.
Right. So thank you in advance. And it's good to be here. So, all right. Well, let's see. I grew up in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. My mom's family is from Montgomery, Alabama. But her dad, my grandfather, is a great man. He was went to Yale. He served in the Navy and was on both fronts, both theaters or what have you, and has some amazing stories from World War II.
You know what we call that? Unlucky.
Yeah, exactly. And he was a great man. And so he went to Yale Law School after he served and did very well. And then clerked for a Supreme Court justice. He was lucky enough to do that, who was from the South. So there was a connection there, because he was from Selma, Alabama, my great-grandfather. And another funny sidebar, my grandfather, his mother, or his grandmother, remembers hiding jewelry in Alabama in the backyard from the Union soldiers coming in, because they would take all the jewelry from the houses.
Yeah, plunder.
So that kind of cool history, wild history. So anyhow, and after that, he later on got appointed a federal judge by Jimmy Carter. So he's served, and he was a great guy, and I loved him. He's passed. My grandmother's passed too. She was a piece of work. Her nickname was the General. She was not the warmest of people, but she was a real trip, everyone loves her. But she was tough on everyone, especially my mom. My dad. So I had that Southern Alabama roots, and then my dad's family. They were granted land in upstate South Carolina in 1700s by King George III.
No kidding.
Yeah, like 40,000 acres, let's call it. And it's now, the town is called Boykin, South Carolina. That's my dad's side of the family, the Boykins. And so that was pretty cool. And it's great hunting land. We go there now. The family tree is crazy, because in South Carolina, from the 1700s on, pretty much every family has someone that slept with each other. And so everybody's somehow involved. I meet people who are like, I'm your distant cousin all the time. So got some historical roots in America, basically. And I mean, back to my mom's side. They came west from New England. Early 1800s, late 1700s, and settled in Chicago, and started the railroads in Chicago, and ended up selling that to the Vanderbilt family at some point.
No kidding.
And then they bought a ton of farmland in Southern Illinois and other real estate holdings. So anyhow, my dad's dad, other grandfather, served. And he was in the Army in the tank division. Under Patton. He was in Patton's tank division. So pretty cool there. And he was a good guy and a tough guy. Anyhow, he started working for Armco Steel out of Ohio and Middletown, Ohio. And he was an international steel businessman. So my dad grew up in Genoa, Italy, and speaks fluent Italian. And we went back there and met his nannies, and it was really cool. So my dad loves Italy and I feel like we have roots there, and that started my dad's love affair with traveling and being abroad and seeing different cultures and people, and really opening your mind. So my dad has really advocated that for me and my sister and my brother, and then we're passing it on to my nieces and nephew, and that's a beautiful thing. So dad moves back, obviously. Goes to college in Suwanee. It's University of the South in the mountains of Tennessee. Meets my mom. They get married. My mom was 21. My dad's 26.
Yeah, that's not bad.
No, it's the time, sign of the times, I guess. And then my dad gets a job as a lawyer in Hilton Head. And that's where I grew up. And really idyllic. I mean, I can't, you know, we were at Rhythmia talking about a lot of trauma that our fellow attendees were sorting through. Man, I just rode my bike around, my mountain bike all around, and terrorized the neighborhood in a not dangerous way, but shooting squirrels with BB guns and things like that, and just being a kid. And there was really nothing wrong. There was nothing bad that could happen. It was like a giant playground. Yeah. It was beautiful. You could get eaten by an alligator. that was one thing, but there wasn't any crime. There wasn't any like bad actors. It was kind of beautiful. It was great. And so I did that, grew up there, loved sports, loved, did pretty well in school. I was very ADD. there's a story where my mom took me, this was in the early days of Ritalin and Adderall, Adderall wasn't yet invented. And she went into a doctor's office, and they put me in a table not unlike this one, by myself. And there was a two-way mirror. I didn't know it was two-way, but the scientists were watching me, and I took a test, and And when it was over, they said to my mom, well, we have good news and we have bad news. What's the good news? The good news, he did very well on the test. Okay, what's the bad news? He laid underneath the table and put the test, like, on. I was on my back, and that's how I took the test. It was, they're like, we've never seen anything like that. Like, that's highly irregular. So I started taking Ritalin, and it helped. Man, it helped. But it was also, now we're, like, delving in. I don't know how deep you want to go.
We go deep here. We go deep. It's your show, man.
Okay, cool. And so I started taking it, and it worked, but it changed my personality, I don't think, to the better. I remember not leaving math class. Math was right before lunch, and I wouldn't leave until my teacher had explained everything and that I fully understood it. And this poor teacher was probably like, man, I just want a cigarette. I just want a cigarette and a sandwich. And so I would go into the cafeteria, and my friends were, hey, sit with us. No. I'd sit by myself and just stew in math or whatever, science. And then eventually it would wear off and like at the end of the day, and I was back to normal. So I thought that was a little bizarre, but I did get really good grades. And so I stopped taking that. And then I went to boarding school in Virginia, this very nice school called Episcopal High School. And my sister was there.
All 4 years?
Now I'll get to that. I went sophomore year and then got kicked out senior year. my sister was there before me. She's super smart. Like, she's cum laude and all these scholarships and just a really smart gal and cool too. She was cool. So she showed me the ropes. The older guys liked me, even though they ribbed me about my sister endlessly. I ended up making good, you know, a lot of good lifelong friends. But here's how I describe boarding school, at least, was my buddies were back home. They just got their licenses. They just got a brand new truck. And I was in a dorm room, and they were like, you can't go there. You can't go there. You can't talk to that girl. I mean, it was pretty restrictive. And so I would obviously, we had a bunch of kids who were testing the electrocuted fences, basically. And I got zapped too many times and asked to leave. So anyhow, no big deal. It seems like a big deal at the time when you're younger, but I was always sort of a rebel, and devil may care, but I also got my work done, you know. There's a somewhere of a medium there. You know, there's a quote, something like the world is run by C students or B students or something like that. I think
who developed the soft side of their skills.
Yeah.
In our people, you know, salesmen. Usually most salesmen, well, let me back up. Most millionaires had an average of a 2.9 GPA in college.
Yeah, I believe it. Because that type A can hold you back. I certainly was never type A, but so I probably had like a 3.2.
So you had an affinity for breaking the rules, which...
Correct.
If I look at the SEAL teams, all the guys had a common trait, is they didn't like the rules. Right. We're always finding ways to get outside the rules or break the rules.
Sure.
But it was also like a strong trait that they were innovative.
Yeah.
And they were hard charging.
Yeah.
And they could just never stop.
Right.
So I see that as a good thing. You always want your son to have a little bit of what I call healthy disrespect for authority.
Yeah. A little rascal.
Hit him. And I know some people are like, oh, it's so wrong. No. I encourage it just a little.
Oh, and you know, you see these memes or you speak to women and they're like, God, I always go for the bad, you know, for the naughty boy. You see, and there's something there. I don't know what it is.
Because they're fun.
Yeah. Never a dull moment, I suppose.
So did you go back to Hilton Head, went to Hilton High School?
Yeah. Oh my God, that was painful. I mean, it was just, my parents were so disappointed and the college that I got into said I couldn't go anymore. And my dad was all upset. But I ended up, we got like a college advisor. I graduated unceremoniously from Hilton Head High School and went to University of Georgia. And best thing that could have happened, I think, because it's a big pond. I could be myself and not have to worry about authority too much because I was
University of Georgia is, 30, is a lot of fun.
30,000 people. Yeah. I can guarantee whatever I'm doing, someone else is doing it harder and faster there. So
what town is University of Georgia?
Athens.
That's right.
So, joined a fraternity there with a bunch of boarding school guys, as well. And did okay. And I loved it. I mean, academically, I don't know if I, it was, I like to say the smartest I ever was 11th grade at boarding school. Like I was reading esoteric Shakespeare plays and like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is Dead by Tom Stoppard. And I was like understanding Chaucer and all this stuff and enjoying it. And then started smoking pot. My brain got clouded. I guess. I don't know. I just, that there was an innocence and like an actual academic pursuits. Once I think college is kind of a waste of time, unless you go to a small liberal arts college.
Agree.
Yeah.
Agree. Where you're forced to study.
Yeah, you got a class of 25 people and you gotta sink or swim. I mean, that's what it's, but I was in lecture halls with 300 people.
Yeah. I found that hard too. My first go around was quite unsuccessful, but when I went back as a Marine, with a focus, plus they're going to send you back to the Marine Corps if you fail. It was easy. Plus, I was older, but it's
where not, was your first go-around?
University of Colorado at Boulder.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that could be tough to get lost in the shuffle.
Kicked out of the NROTC unit, failing grades, withdrew from all my classes, and went and enlisted in the Marine Corps before my old man, who's a scary individual, loving individual, but also very scary in his own right, before he could get his hands on me, and I was off.
Was he ex-military too?
So my dad had, he got drafted and at boot camp, or was it boot camp or his school after boot camp, it was at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And they had everyone lined up and they said, hey, we're looking for people with a very special skill who played competitive football. And like three guys' hands went up. My dad was one of them. They're like, go outside, and ended up on the Fort Polk, Louisiana football team.
Wow.
Playing for the base, which base football was very, like it was like commanders against other base commanders. Yeah. It was a point of pride. So ended up playing football, didn't go to Vietnam, got out. And you got to understand the Army was a completely different organization back then. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like World War II. Mm-hmm. Vietnam, like if you did something wrong, they took you around the back of the barracks and beat the living snot out of you. So it wasn't the most stellar leadership style. But back to your point about the last time you were – it was the last time you were focused when you were 11, because then you discovered all these extracurricular activities.
No, 11th grade.
11th grade?
Yeah.
My last one was, my ninth grade. Freshman, pretty much had all A's, and then girls, parties,
right.
Alcohol,
right.
Surfing. Like, where's the next fun?
Yeah.
It was downhill from there until the Marine Corps.
I feel that. So, finished that. Finished college and went to Charleston, and
why Charleston?
It's a great town.
Oh, yeah, no, agreed.
It's near Hilton Head, where I grew up.
How far?
2 hours. And Charleston was always this town where everybody wanted to be, but it was hard to. It was the barrier to entry was fairly high because they're not handing out jobs at the border. I mean, it's a lot of food and beverage and hospitality. And then there's a hospital, and you can be a lawyer, but that's kind of a lot of, nepotism and stuff. So they keep it. You can't stay there and make a good living. To this day, it's getting easier. There's tech and stuff, but this was 20 plus years ago. So moved there, got a job with a family friend in real estate, and started dating the first real love of mine, and. But the problem with the job was literally the first week, he was this kind of cool guy in his 30s, late 30s. And he had three kids by his ex-wife. And he was like gung-ho and cool. I liked him. And but the first week I got the job, he gained custody of his three kids because his wife was getting remarried. So they're ages 11, 8, and 6. And I'm almost all of a sudden like his fourth kid. So we sort of didn't make any money there for a year. But it was great. He was like, hey, instead of coming into work, will you take my son surfing? I was like, yeah. And I wasn't even getting paid, but I was in love with this girl and had my friends in Charleston and was just, it was a really lovely time, a wild, fun time, but a lovely time. And finally, my mom and dad were like, you need to get a job, a real job. So
a J-O-B.
Yeah. They got me a job down in Florida in West Palm with Pulte Homes, which is, a you know, the, they make track homes. Or I mean, they're nice, but yeah, they're little communities.
So basically in real estate still selling track homes?
Selling communities, yeah. Gated communities with, you know, a pond in the middle, and you know the drill. And especially in Florida, they're everywhere. Retirement type places. So I did that. I went down there, and it was fun. I had a ball. Learned a lot. And one day I was sort of bored with my job, and my grandparents were there, and I was living in the house that they owned, but they're only there a month out of the year, and it was right on the water. It was cool. But
in West Palm.
No, in Jupiter Island.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. But Jupiter Island wasn't that cool. I mean, it was old rich people.
But beautiful. I mean, you were close to the beach, you could surf.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. But, you know, if I wanted to go out, it was a 45-minute cab, and there weren't a lot of cabs back then. Yeah. So I would just get in my car on Friday and just go and stay with friends in Palm Beach. And so maybe that was a good thing. But, being far away from the parties and stuff, I definitely didn't throw any parties at the house because there people wouldn't come. It's too far. So I was living there with my.
That's a lack of promotion.
I tried.
That's a total lack of promotion.
I mean, before social media, you know, like I couldn't even like tell people. I couldn't. Yeah. So anyhow, my grandparents were like, "We're going to the club to," because Greg Norman is speaking there, and this was a long time ago. Like I said, 20 plus years ago. And I was a fan of his. And I said, oh, I'll go with you. So I went and he spoke about his businesses and all this stuff. And they were like, okay, well, what are you doing for dinner? I was like, I'll meet you back at the house. I'm going to stay here and talk to Mr. Norman, maybe if I can. So I stood there and I waited till he went through all this stuff. And I said, Mr. Norman, I'm Shep. I admire you, you know, you as an athlete, but as a businessman, and I would love to talk to you about maybe, you know, a job or something in that. And he was like, he looked at me and then he goes, talk to my guy here, Bart. And I was like, okay. And he looked like a sharp guy. And he's like, here's my card. Just email me. I'll get back to you. And 4 months later, 3 months later, I got a job with Medalist Developments. But that's the funny part about that is I went and interviewed, and this guy, Frank Weed, who's a great guy, he's from North Carolina, he was talking to me, and he's like, what's your name? I was like, Shep Rose. And then about halfway in, he goes, what's your mom's maiden name? I said, Hobbs. And he goes, Francis Hobbs? I was like, yeah. I was like, what? He's like, I went out on a date with her.
No way.
In college. And I go, oh, my God. So that was kind of cool. And then I called my mom after the interview. I was like, I was like, do you know who Frank is? He goes, yes, he got arrested on our date and we had to go bail him out of jail. So I was like, I think I'm with the right outfit here, you know? And I got the job and that was cool. And I did market research and land acquisitions, trying to find new places to build golf courses and communities. And man, it was a dream, man. It was cool. I was working for Greg Norman and his cohorts. And so that was cool. And, then they were like, hey, you need to go back. You need to go to business school. A few of my people, older guys I respected. And I was like, all right. And I applied to a few. I applied to McCombs here in tech in Austin, came down and visited, had a nice time, and ended up going to Vanderbilt Business School and in Nashville. And boy, has it changed. I mean, that was in 2006.
So was Austin.
Yeah, Austin.
But those two are so analogous.
Like, I know.
Austin in Nashville are so alike.
Yeah.
And do you know that Austin claims music capital of the United States, which I think is completely wrong. They go, it's Nashville, man. You or can't LA compete with that.
Or New York. Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, so, yeah, so I did that. And then I remembered when I worked for Greg Norman, I one day was told to take this guy out and show him around different projects around West Palm. And he was this Australian guy, and I liked him. His name is David Spencer. And he started giving me a hard time, and I was like, I'm going to give it right back, at which he loved. And so we were sparring and laughing and stuff. And then I just remembered him, and he ended up going to Dubai and working for the Sovereign Fund, building golf courses in the middle of the desert. And between my first and second year of business school, they asked you to do an internship. And I thought, you know, it'd be cool if I could somehow connect with him and get a job or an internship in Dubai. And so was able to do it. He was cool as hell, very enthusiastic. They'd never done that before, but they liked the idea of it. So I shipped off to Dubai and
for a summer.
Yeah. And what a time I had there, man. It was just amazing. I stayed in a Holiday Inn Express all summer.
Yeah. Which is probably cheaper than renting a house.
Yeah.
Dubai is not cheap, man. No. When's the last time you've been back?
It wasn't long ago, a couple of years. Yeah. It's changed a lot too.
Oh, yeah.
So I had a driver named Samir who didn't understand a word I said, and we loved each other. He called me Seth. And I was like, Samir, you're the best. He would pick me up with strange ladies, you know, all over Dubai. And I'd be like, can you give her a ride home in the morning? And he's like, oh, yes. Oh, this is great. And then I worked, and they were selling houses at a clip that's amazing. I mean, they were doing $300 million in a weekend. Things were humming. This is the summer of 2008, right before the fall.
Crash.
Yeah. And Sheikhs, were coming in and buying 10 houses at $10 million apiece.
No kidding.
And then the buildings there were empty in the marina. They were brand new, tall buildings with zero lights on at night. And I asked a friend, well, what is that? Oh, that's Russian mobsters or oligarchs build these buildings, and they have no tenants because they don't want any wear and tear. And then they turn around and sell it 2 years later, their money's laundered. So there's a lot of, I was told under no uncertain terms not to play around with Russians, you know.
To include the women.
Well, yes, that too. No, totally. That was the implication. But I ended up dating a girl from Bulgaria, but which isn't Russia. She's from Sofia. Her name was Zornita. She goes, called me Zizi. And I was like, I will call you Zizi. And then she one time said to me, Shepherd, I have never met anybody quite like you. I was like, you haven't, have you?
She wanted to get married.
I don't know. She wanted to come to America.
And of course.
I was like, hell yeah. She was lovely. What a great girl. Afterwards, after the summer, they were like, great job. Would you like to come back and work for us permanently after you're done business school? I was like, hell yeah. What's the pay? They were like, yeah, we'll start you at $125K and
all expenses paid for.
Yeah. And you'll travel around the world to look at projects that we might want to do a new golf course resort at. So whether it be Cape Town or an old castle in Ireland, I was like, this is the dream, right? Yeah. And my dad was so happy for me, man, because he was like, that's what he wanted for me, because he was the international guy, right?
Education.
Yeah, education, broaden your horizons, and be an international man of mystery. So I came back riding high, bro. And my parents couldn't have been happier, my dad especially. And I went back to business school, and everybody's like, what? Like, I was like,
oh, yeah, you had the best stories compared to that. You worked at AT&T or went to Google for their internship.
Yeah, or Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas, the dry county. I had a few friends that did that. They were like, I don't recommend it. But and then it happened. October 2008 happened. Bear Stearns, Lehman's, and it's kind of cool. On a certain level, because it was happening while I was in business school. So all these professors were like, you have no idea about the historical significance of what's going on. And so I had a front row to that. I didn't even know what it meant. I was never really into the stock market and I knew that I wasn't good at like spreadsheets and like organizational stuff. So I knew that wasn't my path, but you had to take all those classes. So I was paying attention. And it was over, man. The party was over and nobody was hiring.
So they called you and said, hey, we're going to have to retract that offer.
They didn't even call, man. Yeah. Okay. It was like, I couldn't get them on the phone, you know, and I called my friends and they were like, bro, we're running for cover. That was when people were leaving their Mercedes at the airport because they blamed the West for all their ills that the UAE did. And like even my friend David or my boss, David, he had to, you know, flee. I mean, I don't know what would have happened, but...
Because he was running the Sovereign Fund.
He was working with the Sovereign
Fund. I've heard some interesting stories where, one, you know, Faza, the crown prince of Dubai, where they've taken passports.
Yeah.
They said, no, you haven't fulfilled the value of what we paid you.
Yeah.
And you're going to be here and work for another 6 months before we give you
sure.
a passport.
Yeah. I'm sure that happened. Yeah. So anyways, that's over. And furthermore, no one's hiring anywhere, especially resort development. So I was a little unnerved, and I ended up trying to start a franchise, a restaurant, be a franchisee of a restaurant out of Atlanta. And that was, I was optimistic about that, but I had the rug pulled out from under me at the 1 yard line. Excuse me. It was pretty disheartening. And the worst part about when you have something you're excited about and you tell your friends and family and then it doesn't come, you have to tell that story again and again, because you keep getting reminded about it. And so I was pretty down, man. I was depressed. And because I have to start all over. I just spent 8 months like cultivating this and putting together LLCs and looking at real estate and getting excited about that. And then it was over. And they were like, oh, you'll find something else. I was like, yeah, I'm sure I will. But what the, you know. So not everything works out the way it should for us. But funny how life works. I meet the creator of our show at a rooftop party in Charleston, and we just hit it off right away.
With another party, you were with the same parties?
Yeah, no, it was just a big this guy Neil Stevenson, who threw awesome parties and they were famous. One time he had one with a teepee and a body painter. So you go into the teepee, and he had like a fire. It was on the rooftop, and it was so cool. Thank you, Neil. And I met Whitney, our creator, and we just hit it off. I did give him a business card because he was like, I'm doing the show, and I'd love to talk to you about it more because you seem like a good fit. And so I gave him this business card. At the time, it said, it just was one guy punching another guy in the balls, and it said, go fuck yourself. And that's it. No number, no nothing.
You won't forget that business card.
He loved it. And he was like, let me buy you lunch tomorrow with my business partner. So we went, and they were interesting guys. They were plugged into the Hollywood scene. They knew all the agents and all that stuff. And I didn't know anything, man. I was never an actor. I was an athlete and a hellion.
You were being yourself.
Yeah. They loved it. Turns out there's a place for that. Yeah. Being a rascal or whatever. Disobedient, basically, and devil may care. And we went and filmed a test run up at my family's farm in Boykin, and it went interestingly. I mean, I'd never been on camera before, but 4 months later, I get a call like, "Hey, they love you. They love the premise. They love you. Here's a contract. Go." So. That's how it all came about. And it was right when the other thing collapsed. You know, it's crazy. And so it's funny to think if I would be like a franchisee in a town in the South somewhere.
You definitely would not have the interesting life you have now, my friend.
No, I wouldn't. I'd be chopping onions.
I don't want the dollar amount, but was the contract worth your time, or was it mainly the opportunity?
Think teacher's salary less, you know, less. That's first year. That it's an unproven entity. Hadn't proved anything, and then they just did 8 episodes. They were like, well, let's see if it gets any traction, and it's been a crazy sequence of events that has all led to the popularity of the show. I mean, we had a really great original cast. This larger than life guy who ran for was the state treasurer, but then got arrested and for cocaine. But he's from one of the oldest families in Charleston, and the bridge is named after his father. So that's one guy, and he's outrageous. I still think he's like worthy of, he should have his own show or something, but he's since left and all this stuff. And then there was this beautiful girl who was on The Real World. Originally, but she's from South Carolina and she was living in Charleston, and she's like America's sweetheart. She's funny, sharp, quick-witted. And so, and then there's me, and then Whitney and his mom, they were part of the creator, and his mom were very interesting, funny. Like, they just moved down from New York and bought a nice big house, and they were meeting everybody in society. That's how the whole show got conceived. He was meeting all these colorful Southern people at these dinner parties when his mom was being introduced into this world. And he was like, there's something here, man. There's something about these Southern colorful old school characters that he saw the potential in.
And to that point, there were really no shows of showing the old Southern.
No, that's what it was. It was the answer to the stereotype of Honey Boo Boo.
Yes, right? Exactly.
These people are erudite and they are well-read and well-spoken and they're quite interesting. Sort of like a Mark Twain sort of pursuit, I guess you could say.
How many original cast members, the OGs, are still standing?
Me and Craig. Craig at the time was just graduated from law school. He was 24 or 5. He's come the longest out of all of us. I mean, I've been on TV for 10 years. It's crazy. Like you haven't seen the audience hasn't seen everything because that's ridiculous. But they've seen me definitely some permutations and variations of my personality and my hopefully evolving. maturity and things of that nature. So it's been a wild ride. I mean, I it started as, you know, I was myself. I mean, I can't be anyone else. And it was working. And I was having a lot of fun and I was getting a good response from people. And my friends and family were excited for me, happy for me. And they liked the show on the whole. And all of a sudden I had this new sort of pursuit. I never saw it as a job. It's funny. I was like, this isn't a job. This isn't a career. I still don't think it is, but it is a job. It's not necessarily a career unless who knows what's going to happen when it's all said and done. But I always was like, this is going to end tomorrow. So what are you going to do to catapult yourself? Maybe using the popularity of the show.
Of course. Whatever.
So I started this hat company that I gave you. It's called Shep Gear. Shep Gear, yeah.
Shep Gear.
Just American flag hats. And did that, made shirts too. It was never like a gangbusters thing. I probably should have taken it further, but I didn't. It's okay.
Still can.
Have that idea from, remember from Rhythmia. Follow your heart, but... it says Wallif, which is follow backwards and an arrow across your chest. And you look in the mirror, it says follow your heart. I had that vision one night in Rhythmia.
Ayahuasca is good for some things.
Dude.
Creativity.
Well, it is. And I was thinking to myself on ayahuasca, I know we're jumping around here, but who cares? I was like, wait a second, you shouldn't be thinking about commerce right now. And then I thought, wait a second, Jerry, dude, from Rhythmia, who started the whole thing, he sure as hell thought about commerce during his revelation. He was told to start Rhythmia. And look at him now. I mean, that place is humming.
It is.
And it's a pretty slick operation and a good one.
What is the filming like per season? How long does that run? 1 month, 2 months?
Yeah, it's 2.5, 3 months, maybe more.
Is that day to day?
It's probably 5 days a week.
5 days a week.
And you could do, or you could have 3 days a week. And you know, it's not like I wake up and there's cameras there, you know, it's a little more, it's at least locationally planned out. And, but you know, no one tells me what to say. I would bristle at that pretty damn hard, honestly.
So I've got to assume,
but you're in this bubble. It's basically like, you're in a shoebox, like a bunch of cats in a shoebox, and they're rattling it up. And that's what it's for 3 months. And you love these people. I mean, I would never pretend to make this a parallel.
It's okay.
But you're in a foxhole with these people, and they only know about the situation, and you only know. The outside world can speculate or whatever, but you were there, and you were face-to-face, and you were trying to... sort it all out with each other.
Do they try to instigate drama a little bit? Is there a little?
See, that's the beauty of our show. It happens. It just happens. That's
put humans together, and it's gonna politicking
and you know, a little bourbon usually. Yeah. I mean, we're always having fun. There's always a party to go to and things like that. So, it just happens. I do not respond well to authority, as we've covered. So they don't tell me what to say or do. That would be problematic in my world. And I know what to say or do. But that's not to say I'm strategizing. I am myself, and that's it. That's all you're going to get.
And is it 3 months, 9 months off, 3 months, or is there 3 months, 6 months off?
No, it's typically 9 months or more, because it takes months to produce the show and churn it out. And so when that comes out, it's a whole new, you know, you're doing press and things like that. So it's a whole new sort of busy bee stuff. Mm. And
so the Bravo team, are you assigned like a PR sort of rep?
Yeah. Yeah. They're lovely. They're lovely. So yeah, it's an interesting life, no doubt. And I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't trade it. It's been good. Yeah. Yeah.
I have no doubt it opens a ton of doors. I mean, you've got a massive following. And that's probably an understatement. BravoCon.
It's hard to even fathom the following, honestly. Like 900 something thousand. That's like a bigger than any army in the world.
Yes.
And then I get in trouble sometimes, or have gotten in trouble, and probably will continue. I'll do something on Instagram that I think is funny, or my buddies might think is funny, but it's not so funny, or it's not so cool. Yeah.
Well, there's always going to be fringes, man.
Yeah.
You can't please everyone.
Well, I've screwed up a few times, so, and it sucks, man. You feel like the weight of the world is on you, but man, it's a small price to pay. Life is good. I would never complain. And, you know, you're able to do some good things too. You know, I love promoting friends, whatever, business, career, but I'll do it if I'd like the product or the person. I'll do it gratis, you know, no big deal. Because, you know, the whole rising tide lifts all boats. Mm. I firmly believe that. And it's good karma. It's just, so I try to keep it on that sort of level. And I hope I do a bang up job.
The bad and the ugly. You do open an aperture into your life for people to see.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be some times where you're just like, hey, I need some time to myself. I need to disappear. I mean, do you ever feel like that?
I do, man. I mean, I've had some really low moments, and like literally been in my car saying, I'm just going to disappear during filming. I had a relationship on camera, and it was very tough on that. You know, it's just the strings that were being pulled, not strings, but threads being pulled, and things were unraveling in real time. And I just it was very traumatic, dramatic and traumatic. And so that was tough. And then there's things when you know you did something that you shouldn't have, said something, and you just, you know that other people are talking about it. That's the name of the game. And you're just getting dragged through the mud, but it's your fault. You can't blame anybody else. I'm in control of what comes out of my mouth, yada, yada, yada. So
let's be honest. If you had a camera on you for pretty much 5 days a week for 3 months straight,
yeah,
there's going to be things that happen where people they're going to judge.
I know.
It's like if you had an open mic in our office, like people would hear things we say, and they just wouldn't get the humor.
Yeah,
that we grew up with. He's from Texas. Yeah. Grew up on a ranch. You know, I was amongst a Spartan community. You've got to be careful these days.
I know.
And the problem with social media is, and we all know this, I'm saying, it's like anyone can make an anonymous comment with very little context. Mm-hmm. And have you learned to tune that out, or do some of those comments? I don't want to say resonate, but you're like, damn, man, that sucks.
Sometimes one will bubble to the surface and I don't even mean to see it. And then I admonish myself for even poking around, basically, because I don't poke around. I learned that early. There's blogs. There's a whole universe of people weighing in. And
Reddit.
Yeah, well, yeah. And just Bravo. I mean, Bravo fans, man, that's the secret sauce to this whole thing. They're like the most loyal fans ever. Not to say that they're all peachy keen and on the up and up, but the fact that the show is continuing to go means, yes, positive fans are a big part of it, but it's also people talking and people slinging mud and things. So I decided consciously to stay out of that big time. Because it can be really disheartening, and you can feel like, oh, what am I doing this for? But then there's just so many normal people who aren't commenting and are appreciate what you do and appreciate the show and maybe appreciate your point of view, even if it is controversial.
Or but
they don't talk.
No.
You know, there's the silent majority. Yeah. We've given the microphone to the fringes these days and then validated their opinions. And it's dangerous because, I mean, show me the middle, man. And that's where I kind of want to reside.
You know, I'm no one. Like, and I'm not trying to create a following. I mean, Sammy content commented the other day. She's like, you need to be more personal on your social. I'm like, not going to happen. I'm business forward, but occasionally I'll get a comment that just sucks. And I'm like, man, I almost want to reply to that person, but I'm not going to dignify their comments with the response.
There you
go. It's an interesting dilemma.
I used to fight back a lot. I learned the hard way, especially
don't get down in the mud with the pigs.
Yeah.
You'll become and I'm not saying, you know, if you're just an everyday person, you know, it's how you handle your comments.
Yeah. Twitter was a problem. I had to get off of it.
I can only imagine. If you can comment with criticism or a varying point of view with some professionalism, grace, and tact, we'll have a conversation.
Yeah.
If you can act with some decorum.
Yeah.
And if not, then I'm not going to give you my time, but that's for anyone.
Yeah.
Regardless of your profession or if you have a following, but I've got to assume that each of the characters, like, is there a score? They're like, hey, Shep, your audience reaction is this. Craig, your audience reaction is no.
They don't share that. I'm sure they do focus groups maybe. But
and is that determine who comes back on?
I'm sure that there's a part of that, yeah. And I think, I mean, unless I do something stupid, which I have, and that's kind of the reason I was at Rhythmia, because I was showed my ass at BravoCon. In,
what happened?
It was in Vegas, so I'm not part of it.
We're judging people based off of what happens in Vegas now. That's why I avoid that city.
Yeah, well.
Like, I don't want to tell you stories.
Somebody said, you can either go to Vegas to work or have fun. You can't do both. And what I failed to realize is that I was there somewhat to work or you know, and to meet all the fans and be as gracious and kind and appreciative of all them. And then to take part in the different events earnestly and you know, and sound mind and body. And I got to Vegas, and I think the first night I behaved, but then I had like 3 hours the second day of downtime, or 4 hours, and I just went to the blackjack table, started drinking bourbon and gingers. And
free drinks.
Yeah, and then showed up at a taping of and I was loud and obnoxious. Again, it was not like, I guess... I heard through the grapevine, like, people were like, oh boy, and that's okay, but it's not okay. And, you know, it's a fine line. It's just a fine line because part of Bravo is part of the show is letting loose and being outrageous. And so you can trick yourself into thinking that that's your identity. And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
So do you feel like you've become a caricature of yourself
sometimes,
for which people don't fully know you?
Yeah.
And they only get the snapshots that the Bravo team decides to put into an episode.
Yeah. But then again, I'll make mistakes and prove people right. Prove the naysayers right. And that's what pisses me off, is when I prove the naysayers right. I'm like, no, don't give the red meat to the lions. You know what I mean? And that's on me, man. And I just... I had an identity as a wild man and a lot of fun and, you know, also, you know, cavalier about life basically. And, that was who I was. And the problem, I guess, was like, if you can't do that continually for years and years, if you have a 9-to-5, I mean, you just can't,
no.
You know,
like, no, I've tried, it doesn't work.
But here I was doing well professionally, I guess you could call it. And then being, you know, that behavior was, I wouldn't say rewarded, but not discouraged, because it's what paid the bills. So that's what I told myself in the morning when I was like, what happened? Oh, well, price of doing business. But when the cameras are off, that's a whole, I mean, on or off, it doesn't matter. It's your life. It's leased my life. And so I was, I can't. And so I got in a little bit of trouble with some of the powers that be. And I got a really lovely call from Andy, who's a great guy. And he was just like, he's like, look, I want you around, and I want you to be around. I don't want you to not have the decision to be around. And, you know, you want to, you know, things to end on your own terms if possible.
Yeah.
And it was a great call, and I really appreciated it. And
a wake up call.
Yeah. And it was fun. He was so cool, but, and I was very much appreciated. And then I reached out to my two buddies on the show and was like, I need to talk. And I think they had it. They were frustrated by my, I don't know what they were, how they feel. I care about them a lot, and I try to do things for them as much as I can. And we're all in this together, Foxhole Theory back. And I asked to like chat with them, like over lunch, I'll buy you lunch. And they weren't willing to hear me out. And that's okay. That's okay. That's your choice. But that really hurt. And I had a lot of trouble with that.
And was that fairly recent?
That was before I went to Rhythmia. That was in November. And I was just like, okay, I guess I got to do this by, like, they're the only ones that would understand some of the, how this, you know, where are we at this moment, you know? And I mean, there's a whole other aspect of, you know, obviously I'm just becoming increasingly susceptible to taking it too far, and my body and mind can't handle it anymore. I can't run as hard as I used to. And I'm being told by myself that's not okay anymore, but it's a lesson hard learned. And I know that we texted, you know, recently about stuff like that. And, you know, it's pattern of behavior. It's a very old, worn down pattern of behavior, and it's hard to find a new groove, but that's what we must do.
It to resort to what you know requires no effort whatsoever.
Yeah.
But to make those iterative changes to get where you want, that is the hardest battle, and everyone's battling something. And you ultimately chose to
being
go
comfortable
to,
is the biggest addictive thing that you can in the world, basically, right?
And it takes time. You're not going to get off the wagon or get off the horse immediately. It's going to be a little bit of back and forth. You're going to fall back to your old ways as long as you can assess and reflect and identify how to make those changes. But you ultimately chose to go to Rhythmia, and we're going to dive into Rhythmia deep with John Wellborn, Sanjay, you and me.
But yeah, though that was so I was like, okay, and then Mike, I mean, it happened again in Charleston, and I was watching football all afternoon with some guys, and then went downtown at, you know, steakhouse, met Whitney and Austin, and I shouldn't have been out, and especially downtown, you know. And people buy me martinis and shots, and all of us, really. It's like a maelstrom, you know, and it was a Saturday night, and a lot of tourists around, a lot of people, a lot of fans. And so you better mind yourself, because you can quickly be in a compromising position. And I jumped right in, and it was, I don't, you know, so it happened again after Vegas, and I was, those boys were kind enough and friend to put me in an Uber, and I went home, and I woke up and was like, what the hell? Am I in control? And what happened, and how bad is it? You know, it's a terrible feeling, a helpless feeling. So that was a big, the one in Charleston was a big wake up, and went to Thanksgiving with my family, the Greenbrier, and in West Virginia, and just was really upfront with everybody. I mean, I didn't like sit them down. I was individually was like, here's how I'm feeling. It's like, and they were like very supportive, and talked to some friends too. And between my friends and family, I got close friends. I got a lot of stories come back to me of similar ilk. Getting older, can't do it the way. I mean, you know, oh, I was at a concert and I was just behaving like I was in my 20s. And boy, I took a stumble and hit my head, you know, like just, these people have kids and wives and jobs, you know? So that was sort of heartening in a way, like, okay, this is a thing and it's happening way more than what people are talking about. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are sober out there that a lot of this kind of stuff happened. But they, you know, who got, you know, their fifth DUI or lost their job or their wife left them. And thankfully none of this stuff happened to me. And I'm okay. But it just, yeah. So anyhow, I decided to go on the reunion show and tell my story, and on national television. And so
which takes a lot of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Cause you're opening yourself up.
Sure.
And I applaud you for that.
Well, it's also getting ahead of it and holding yourself accountable on national TV, no less, you know, and it's just saying I need to be better. And I was hoping that it would resonate. And I think it really did. I mean, boy, you should have seen my DMs when it came out. I was at Rhythmia. It was the final night.
When that show aired?
Yeah. I was in the Maloka and I was like, oh, man, I didn't like belabor it, but I was like, there's a lot going on in my life that I don't even know about right now that's being aired.
And you never said a thing to Sanjay or me?
No.
So that was in the back of your mind?
I made a conscious choice to sort of leave the show out of it, unless Mother Ayahuasca wanted to reveal something to me. But it's been, like I said, it's been an overwhelmingly positive experience. So I wasn't shown anything. I wasn't like dancing with the devil, so to speak, at all. I didn't feel that way. And I chose not to share. I was going to keep those things separate. I went in there. And that's why when I met you guys and you were like, we had a guy drop out. We're doing a documentary. And I had hesitation because I was like, I promised myself I wouldn't be on social media and trying to. But then you guys were so cool. And I was like, you know, this is maybe an opportunity to at least be considered in the same range as you and Sanji. So pretty good company there.
It was a good group. If John was there, oh boy, stand by. We would have blast.
I'm going to give him a hard time. Thank you for dropping out, John, because
we still would have asked you, man.
Oh, really?
Because we met on, I think it was the Sunday morning.
Yeah, at yoga.
Yeah. And we were cracking jokes in the very back because yoga is not something we traditionally do.
We were falling on our ass on the most easy pose.
And there was a natural click. And I also am like, I recognize this guy from somewhere. I'm not a Bravo TV guy.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. But, and I'm like, are you on a show? And you're like, yeah. And you were trying to be as low key as possible and not stay to yourself. But that's, well, dude, you know, in that text stream, you said, hey, this happened last night. And we talked about pattern of behavior. The other thing too, and when I left my last command, I was newly divorced, drove to Austin. I'm single, going through the MBA or about to start the MBA program, and I fell into a bad rut. I mean, we were drinking Thursday night through Sunday night. I met a great crew of guys, but everything revolved around alcohol. Mm-hmm. And as you're talking, like everything revolves around alcohol. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's a hell of a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Going to the bars. We were having a riot. Mm-hmm. And it took me 2 years to figure out. I'm like, and the girl who I'd met saw the pattern of behavior and she's like, yeah, this is going to be no bueno. And I really like this girl. And I'm like, you know what? I need a change of environment.
Yeah.
So for all the listeners, like if you continue to run into trouble, you've got to assess one, the people who you're hanging out with. And again, these were good people. They weren't bad people. They all had 9-to-5s and they were doing extremely well for themselves, but the environment was just toxic for me.
Yeah.
And I was unraveling even further. Like things just got worse and worse and worse. And I did an Irish goodbye. Like just, they were texting me, calling me, wouldn't answer for months. And eventually one of my good friends within that group, Wes, was like, bro, what's up? I'm like, bro, I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I am at the time, I think I just turned 40. I'm like, this is unsustainable. Yeah. And I met a girl that I really like.
Yeah.
And removing myself from the environment was the hardest thing to do, but it was also the best form of self-love I could ever wish for, because I started getting back to the discipline I knew and the accountability I knew. But who, let me ask this.
It's a good point, and it's really hard. Yeah, especially, but you know, a lot of my great, great friends from early days that they've, you know, they went the family route. And so, but then I, you know, then there was me. I was single. I was now on a TV show. I had to find new cohorts. And I certainly did. I mean, I can sniff them out from a mile away. And, but yeah, I think you're right. There's certain people who I love dearly that probably aren't the best for me. And well, maybe they feel the same about me. I bet you they do.
Let's be honest. You know, it sort of validates your life when you those friends that went the family route are like, dude, I'm so fucking jealous of you.
I know.
I'm like, oh, like
that happens.
It's like the wife's in the background yelling, change his diapers. And you're just like, bro. The grass is always greener on the other side.
I know.
100%.
But I mean, it's, and you know, your wife is newly, are we announced that?
Well, yet? We just did. Okay. Publicly. Great. Awesome. Yeah. No, we're at 8 weeks. So thank you. Yeah.
And that's going to be a whole other level of responsibility, but I think a good one, right? I mean, we're not, I don't think meant to chase every whim and be totally selfish our whole life. It's good to be that way for a period of time. It's great. No complaints here. But to have different phases and levels of maturity, I think is something that I'm really interested in at the moment. Unfortunately, I was in a 2.5 year relationship and it ended. And she really wanted me to make some changes. Of course you can't change on someone else's timetable. And now it's sort of the train left the station. And I'm sort of in that headspace now, but, you know, it's okay. I'll regroup. And I don't know. I think relationships are super important with the opposite sex or same sex or whatever for a level of stability and accountability, you know, because it's, yeah.
You can't rush into that. Like, I consider myself blessed. I was married before, divorced. Yeah. And, I found my alter ego in her. But I'll tell you, I am excited about the news, like just beside myself.
Good.
Except for the point where she's like, you know, this means you can't be doing these expeditions anymore. And it was like, wait. Let's circle back on that one because that's sort of the company I'm building with Legacy Expeditions.
That's how the bread is buttered.
I'm like, yes. I'm like, we'll come to that one once the child's born. And well, funny enough, I think she is a late September, early October pregnancy, and I told you I'm jumping out of an airplane at 42,000 in a wingsuit right now. That's the plan.
Wingsuit. You're gonna like cruise around. Okay,
we're gonna try to shoot. Well, I'm supporting. I'm gonna be filming a guy who's trying to break the wingsuit record in terms of vertical distance. He's a Force Recon Marine. He's just a good friend and just a good heart. And in fact, he's a Rhythmia alum.
Oh,
who he said it changed his life.
Cool.
But I want to ask you, man. And what you're describing is a phase everyone goes through, and everyone's phases are different. Have you ever looked in the mirror and say, who's the man I want to be 10 years from now?
No, I never did. I just was like always fly by the seat of the pants, never plan. I don't know where I took pride in the fact that I didn't know where I was going to be in 3 months or two or much less a year.
That's not a bad thing though. Some people live that way and they live just spectacular lives. And you've lived a interesting and spectacular life, but let's say, how old are you now?
44.
44. You see, 44 years young.
Yeah.
Like,
I feel good.
Do you think you need to go through that process of just like, hey, when I'm 55, where do I want to be? Who do I want to be?
Yeah, I know. It's yes, I do is the answer. And, I think a lot of it has to do with, do I want to do the family route? And if not, what is that going to look like? Because I really think it keeps you honest and it provides a pride and that and doing the right thing. I mean, that's why you see these guys that you respect so much because they did it right. You know, I'm trying to think of some guys.
Right is a relative.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. But they sacrificed their own maybe excitement or fun for to raise. I mean, I did have a vision at arrhythmia, I was like, oh, okay. Like the only way to really have a legacy in this world is to raise a good, solid family. Like, and hopefully that's how you're remembered.
Which is your bloodline.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have a very, you guys have a pedigree.
Yeah.
Within the.
I don't think of it that way, but I appreciate that.
No. I mean, that's an interesting, I mean, you guys got roots back to England, the early settlers.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could trace back our family line beyond 1899. We know we come from Italy and the Pyrenees Mountains, but.
Cool.
There is definitely a selflessness.
Yeah.
That you have to have to be a parent, because you are constantly putting aside your needs for a child. And I can't sit here with a straight face and look at you and say, I did that for my two kids, my daughter and my son. I was also going to war, and somebody had to do that because very few people were willing to. And I was surrounded by the guys who were making the same decisions. But it definitely robbed us of the opportunity to be selfless for our kids.
Yeah.
And with my last job, my last command of the SEAL teams, it was just like, go, 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 go. And it was, you just weren't there. So this is not a redo for me. Like, I still have two just beautiful kids, and I need to try to be there for them more.
How old are they?
20. Well, turning 20 here, wow. March 13th and 16 on February 28th. Cool. So, and they've got a good head on their shoulders, but this is definitely going to be a different experience for me. Yeah. What about, and I know that's king on your list, looking for the right partner.
Yeah.
And whether that is for you or not.
No, I think it is. It's funny. I do think, like, whatever projections that I might have in my future, I never saw myself. I sort of scoffed at the white picket fence. I see myself, I always thought that I'd end up with like a Australian girl, a British girl, or someone like that, or a South African or something, because those women, the men in those countries are all animals. Basically. I mean, not all of them, but they're like just...
Australian. I've heard Australian women say they love American men because
they're toned down maybe a little bit. So I thought maybe that would happen for me, that I would be a little less than the competition, a little more palatable than the competition. But I do think there's something cool about living two separate lives. Like, this has been my life up to now. If I meet the right person, I really think I will pursue a completely different reality, no pun intended on that, in a different country or a completely different part of the world, and just sort of reinvent myself and go that route. That sounds interesting to me, and it sounds like a complete rebirth or whatever, born out of commitment and care for another or others. So I think that might be something that I want to do.
It sounds like you're going to ride this opportunity as long as it's there, though.
I guess
the question would be, why wouldn't you? What if it segues to something different?
Yeah, that'd be great. I've got some ideas out there, and you know, we've talked, you've been super supportive. I appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, I'm this space of men's journal, and you know, you and Mark were kind enough to sort of explore that. I'm going to be writing about my experience down there. We'll see where that goes. I love writing. I get incredible satisfaction out of writing and being sort of the eye in the sky at places like Rhythmia. Like I feel so creative. And I feel that same way when I travel, because being the fish out of water, we're not in Kansas anymore. I love that. That makes me percolate. When I run into problems, it's boredom, and I don't have enough to do.
Idle hands.
I'm at home. I know all the bartenders. I know all the wild hellions, and it's right there waiting for you. You know, like the grim Shep. Reaper at the door.
Shep.
Yeah,
join us.
But so if I'm by myself in Scandinavia, which I did last May. I mean, yeah, I had beers, but I was by myself, and I'd never had one single evening that was crazy.
Over the top.
Yeah, no, yeah. There just wasn't.
Where'd you go in Scandinavia?
I went to Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. It was freaking awesome, dude. Loved it.
I still have not hit the Scandinavian countries.
Oh, you've got to. You've got to.
We definitely want to go to, God darn it, Norway, and do a skydiving expedition out in Norway and do the...
Yeah, when are you going to do that?
We've been talking about it for a long time.
Might I suggest something?
Yes.
Because I took a boat from Copenhagen to Oslo. It was really cool. Someone recommended it. It's an overnight boat, and you go through the whatever sea, and I had a nice suite, on a balcony, and it's basically like a cruise ship, but it was just for one night. And so I land in Oslo, and I check into this cool hotel that someone told me to go to, and they were like, "You must be here for Constitution Day." I was like, "What is that? No, I'm not." They were like, "You're not?" They were like, "It's tomorrow. It's our Independence Day. It's our 4th of July." I was like, "What?" I was like, "Cool." They were like, "Yeah, the whole country has a party. It's amazing."
That is awesome.
And so I went to like a gift shop and bought like a Norway soccer jersey and like a scarf and a hat. And I was like, "Okay, I'm going to do the 4th of July thing." So I walk out of my hotel and I look around and everybody's in a sharp suit the women are in like a Norwegian sort of lederhosen, like beautiful dresses. I was like, "Oh shit, no, that's not what they do here. The Americans are the only tacky."
You look like the American amongst you.
The dumb American trying to pimp my little Norway gear. So I quickly changed and had one of the best days. It's at the end of May, and everybody's just, it is so fun. So fun. Everybody's so welcoming and nice. And that goes for all of Scandinavia, for that matter. Everyone's wonderful.
And dude, that's what I'm trying to do with Legacy Expeditions. Is it's not only skydiving into these places, but getting to experience the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to Iceland, and we had to cut that. Will was with us. We had to cut that trip short. Andy Stumpf and I were skydiving into a few locations because the people running it were completely, unsafe. Mm-hmm. And it totally ruined the trip because we were supposed to be there for, 10 days. We cut it short at four? Yeah. Will stayed by himself. He took some beautiful photographs. Beautiful photographs.
Yeah, no, I think that that's an idea I have. I have it written up. A show, sort of Anthony Bourdain without the food, because he really took a deep dive on culture and traditions and stuff tried to make you understand and appreciate.
God, he was good.
He was so good.
Anthony Bourdain passed away, right?
He killed himself.
Killed himself. Isn't that,
it's so sad. But a
guy who you would think is like, this guy's on top of the world, he's impacting lives, was struggling.
Well, and I talked about this at the reunion, in my soliloquy at the reunion. I said, I've always respected people that were a little rebellious and spat in the devil's eye, so to speak. And I was like, I named a few heroes, Keith Richards, Jack Nicholson, Hunter S. Thompson, Hemingway. And I was like, but there's two other people I want to talk about, and that's Owen Wilson and Anthony Bourdain. And Owen Wilson, who I really respect and think is one of the funniest, he tried to kill himself.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was several years ago. And then Anthony Bourdain accomplished that. And I was like, what could they be feeling? They're so respected. Everyone loves them. And I said, they must have felt isolated and ashamed.
I was going to ask you, are there times, even though this massive following the show, you feel lonely?
Yes. And I said that the old adage, you can have a million friends, but no one to talk to. Mm. But my saving grace in those moments is my family and friends, yes, and my ability or inability to keep my mouth shut, which is a good thing, because the communication dissipates a lot of shame, embarrassment. You just got to get it off your chest. And I can only assume those two guys, had a few things happen where they were just unhappy and didn't, and they had so many friends and fans, not that that's someone, but so many people that would love to support them, and they hit a moment, a really toxic cocktail of isolation and shame, and that can produce what it did for at least for Anthony.
Happiness, man.
Yeah.
It's, again, from the outside looking in, people look at Anthony Bourdain and they think, God, he must be the happiest man in the world.
Yeah. Well, I read a book about him. It was interesting. He, by his former assistant, and, as the show got more popular, he became more removed. It became an organism, a business, you know, and he lost some of his wonderment and curiosity. He used to travel in the van with the camera guys and everybody, and by the end he was just by himself. And you know, it's just very sad to think. And
he lost his tribe.
Well, yeah, and you know, he had drug problems. I read his book. He had drug and alcohol problems, and now I'm speculating. I don't know what happened, but it's easy to picture him falling back into some things and being so embarrassed or so shameful. And not having, and then there, I know there was a female that was part of his depression as well. But anyhow, now we're talking about something completely different.
I just interviewed Les Stroud. Do you know who he is? Mm-mm. Survivor Man? Mm-mm. Les Stroud is the GOAT. He is, you know, you've got the, why am I blanking, the British guy, Bear Grylls and all those guys, which he was actually outspoken. He's like, oh, those are the Hollywood guys that have the crews and they don't stay out. Les Stroud was one of the first where he would go out with GoPros and he was all alone and he would put himself in all the different seven continents into these wild environments where he had to survive. And he's getting it on GoPro. And he talked about, they wanted me to move towards Bear Grylls to do these big productions. He's like, no, I won't do it.
Yeah.
And he, you know, was sort of alluding to that. It was his saving grace is that he wasn't willing to take it to a level where it would rob himself of the enjoyment he had outdoors. That's an interesting world, man.
Let me know, man. Well, let's go. I mean, I'll jump out of a plane. Okay.
We'll get you. Let's teach you to skydive first.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get the timing right on that.
I did it once.
Tandem?
Yes. Tandem in Interlaken, Switzerland, out of a helicopter. I thought my head was going to get chopped off by the blades.
Mountains in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
14,000 feet.
Beautiful.
They said I free fell for 90 seconds, but it sure felt like 10, you know?
Yeah, no, that's accurate.
Yeah.
We'll get you trained to jump by yourself.
Is that your one thing that you love to do as far as your travel documentaries or content?
I consider myself a exceptionally mediocre storyteller.
Okay.
That's trying. Okay. But it is one, almost like getting the band back together. Yeah. And a lot of guys on these are like guys I didn't intimately serve with in the military. But when you get veterans, there's a common thread. And just to have the group together to do something that is challenging, that's a little bit risky, that we mitigate the risk. We're really good at mitigating the risk. I get a lot of value from that. And, you know, I talked to you about, we did the seven continents, 7 days. I think the world record is right there. We set four of them, and that destroyed my life for 18 months because I had to handle the bulk of the planning. We had two guys that were handling the each of the spots, except for I had to get involved in Antarctica for that jump, but they would handle the actual jumping out of the plane, coordinate with that, but I had to run the whole business side of the thing. Mm-hmm. And I love my wife. My wife is the greatest source of my joy as well as my kids, but you do need man time.
Yeah,
it's just, that's like, anyone who says otherwise is just like, dude, like, who are you trying to kid?
Yeah.
And so we had a blast. And of course, you know, you put these guys together and there's egos, to include my own. There's politicking, there's the little cliques form. But watching them complete the last jump, and I'm watching them all drink a beer and I'm off to the side. Somebody's like, you must be elated. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool what we just did, but that's the reason right there. And then to watch them go on Fox and Friends a few days after in the morning and watching them was the biggest sense of joy. But here's the thing, and I've got a good friend, Glenn Cowan, who's a Canadian. He's their version of JSOC, retired. And I started to feel depressed because I had felt that brotherhood again.
Yeah.
And then it was just taken away. And of course I internalize like most men do. Yeah. I think that's a source of a lot of depression in that loneliness, that isolation, which leads to suicide for men. And he's like, hey man, you got time to talk? Something doesn't feel right. And we talked and I'm like, bro, I'm feeling the same thing.
Okay.
And so we haven't figured a way to get around that. And I can't hold these as, I'm still trying to get the business model down on this thing. Yeah. Again, exceptionally mediocre storyteller. I'm an exceptionally mediocre business operator as well.
Not by the looks of things.
And looks are deceiving. People don't see me like glancing at the P&L every day. Like, what is wrong here? and I'm over exaggerating, but I would love to get this thing humming as many veterans on these, because it just lets you feel that thrill again. Yeah. You can't feel selling real estate or selling cars or working at Amazon. There's just, from what we did to what, like, to now, there is a missing component in my life. My wife knows it.
Yeah.
She's like, how often do you think about what you did? I'm like, every freaking day. And especially the guys we lost. Yeah. So I'm figuring this out, man.
Question, just out of curiosity, in the SEALs, is it a comprehensive thing? Like, okay, or do they discover that one guy or group of guys is better at skydiving and others are better in the water? That's the thing. You have to be good at everything.
No, you have to hit the standard on everything. But and there's a known bar.
Okay.
Like, hey, you've got to be able to do X skydiving, diving, pistol qual, rifle qual. But then some guys excel beyond others. And some people like get way into skydiving. Other guys get way into shooting.
Yeah.
And again, I consider myself mediocre. I met the bar, jack of all trades. And that's what makes it interesting, is you know who to put forward when you've got to put an explosive on the door. Everyone's like, yeah, so-and-so, he'll place the explosive because he's just so freaking good at that.
Yeah.
Or, hey, who's the one man going through the door? We all know who it's going to be because he's the best on the rifle pistol and at CQC. So it's an interesting bunch. And then there's the guys, the purple squirrels, as we call them, that are just good at everything. And you just hate those guys. You love them, but you're like, dude, what is it about that guy? He's just like, anything he touches, it's gold.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Well, bro, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with? Any nuggets of wisdom? Anything you've learned along the way? Things coming up, your company, where to find Shep Gear?
Yeah. I mean, what I've taken away from it is, as far as being on TV, but I think this tracks in all life, is just be yourself and be honest, and good things will happen. Or things will happen, you know. I mean, there's no promises in this life, and but as long as you're authentic, and we talked about that down in Costa Rica, you know, be authentic. And I really appreciate you guys, because I do get in a bubble, and I love my friends and my co-stars, for example. I think we get disappointed. It can be toxic sometimes, especially when the cameras are off. We're trying to prove ourselves in this way or that way. And friends shouldn't have to have that tone. You know, it shouldn't be a competition, but it certainly is. And I understand it. But I was very appreciative to meet you guys and hear about what you're up to, because I consider you and Mark and Sanjay like friends now, and friends that I can lean on and spend time do cool things with. And I sort of needed that reset. I mean, Rhythmia, thank you. I know that you didn't know who was going to be there that week, but it all seems to work out the way that makes me feel really good about my immediate future. And I'd love to work with you guys, and I'm going to write, and we're going to put some articles up on Mike's page, in Men's Journal online. And that'll be sort of a precursor maybe to a bigger publication. And I'm getting ready to go on a business venture in Charleston that I'm excited about. I'm not really yet ready to reveal it, but if it makes sense, maybe do some videos charting that.
Nice.
And so, it's a reset. It's a course correct. And I feel really good about it. And I feel good about sharing it too, even though my burden of proof is that much higher, you know, and I have that to live up to, which is it's a bit scary too. You know, if I was trying to change and nobody knew it, that would be a completely different thing, you know? And so if I'm here or there and I'm doing the wrong thing, it's going to get back to somebody, and that's a whole another level of disappointment. But I like it. I like the pressure. I perform well under pressure, because I'm ADD. You know, I'll give me the test. I don't have to study. I'll study the last second and cram and hopefully get a B plus. So anyways, I feel good. I'm so glad to have met you. And Casablanca, this is the start of a beautiful friendship, I hope.
Damn straight. Well, I'm glad you're setting a higher bar for yourself. The course correct. That's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. What are we if we don't have high standards for ourselves?
And we don't examine all the time.
Reflect.
Yeah.
One of the most important traits in life. Well, guys, thank you for joining us. Shep Rose, thank you for joining us. Where can people find you? Instagram?
Yeah, Instagram, relationship. I'll be posting. Relationship. That was my nickname that my friends gave me when I was in a serious relationship. Relationship, because I wasn't as fun anymore, and they were like, "God damn relationship! He doesn't have as much fun as he used to." And my dad picked up on it and liked it too, because he would call my single friends when we were in our 20s and be like, "Shep doesn't have any good stories anymore. Tell me what you guys are up to." So it's just
funny.
Yeah, and isn't that indicative of what we talked about before? Like you trick yourself into thinking that, oh, you know, give them what they want. Give the public what they want, or family what they want. But I said this recently, like it was funny. It was funny, even the missteps were like, oh boy, you know, had a little scrape there. But it's just not as funny anymore. It's just not as funny anymore. And so, yeah, hopefully this next step will be fruitful and good in a lot of different ways.
Well, thank you for coming in. With that, we will leave it at that. And we're out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.